This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/JoelDuggan to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 146 for Wednesday, May 6th, 2015. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me, fresh from Hawaii, Mr. Hammond Chamberlain. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
Not too bad. How are things over on Beyond the Playlist and Grumpy Cast?
Beyond the Playlist has been going exceedingly well lately, and GrumpyCast is as much fun as it was the day I started.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, if this stuff wasn't fun, we wouldn't do it, right?
Yeah.
I am still trying to figure out how to get Daryl on the show. We have been in contact, your co-host, your co-grumpy co-host, and unfortunately, he's not into Game of Thrones, so we've got to wait until after this kind of stint is over. But that's good, because it's going to happen around the time that, you know, where everybody's going to be thinking Nerdtacular. So having him on the show will hopefully be kind of like a good precursor to Nerdtacular. I'm still planning on going. I'm in the process of trying to find a cheap flight to get down to Utah. Or I shouldn't say cheap, an affordable flight. There's a certain kind of cash value one can put on flying across the continent. And sometimes it's just like, no, I just can't pay that. And other times it's like, wow, that's actually a pretty good deal, you know? And so I think one of the things I'm going to do, JoelDuggan.com happens to have a web store on it, and I'm going to be doing a sale on my books and I think some prints and commissions and try to drive some commission sales. And the cool thing about that is that if you happen to be a Frog Pants listener or a person going to Nerdtacular or a fan of the Citadel Cafe, and you're going to be in Salt Lake City in July, we can waive the shipping and I can just bring them with me because they're flat. Prints would just kind of fit in my suitcase and like commissions, like original 9x12 art, super easy to fit in a suitcase and keep flat. So we could probably save some shipping there too. Plus, then you get to meet me and have it delivered in person.
And realize just how tall you are.
Yeah.
I swear to you, my memory is basically talking to your belly button.
Okay, well, I'm not that tall, but I appreciate that. I'm not fibbing. I'm definitely just a little over 6'1".
It's like a scene with Jamie and Tyrion when you and I are in the same room.
You're not that short.
I feel it next to you.
Well, yeah. I'm not a light gentleman either, so I tend to be a person of light blockage, I guess, in the room. You know who else is? What I was impressed too is the first time meeting some of the other podcasters that you and I are all friends with, Tom Merritt and Scott Johnson. Neither one of those guys are short people either.
Nope, there's a picture, and I'm nestled nice and firm into his armpit.
Yeah. For those of you that might be wondering about what we're talking about, if you go to nerdtacular.com, you can see all of the upcoming, I guess, podcasting goodness that's happening in Salt Lake City, or just outside of Salt Lake City, I guess, at the Snowbird Resort in the mountains there. That is the weekend of July 29th and 30th, or 30th and 31st?
Last weekend in July and goes into that first day of August.
Yeah, like the when I was looking at flights, I was looking at going in on the 29th, the Wednesday, and leaving on the Monday, which is August 2nd. July 29th and 30th, I think, are the two official days. Plus, there's all this non-official stuff with all the people that hang out there. So nerdtacular.com if you're looking to check that out. And it's all part and partial of the Frog Pants Podcasting Network. I'm not sure why I went up like 8 octaves right there. That's new. I'm part of that family on Comics Coast to Coast with Brian Dunaway, who was on the show last week. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to listen to.
Thanks. Yeah, he's Brian and I have been podcasting for a couple hundred episodes. 115, 120. So we have kind of a decent rapport across the microphones here, and it was neat to get him on a show where it was a different pace than Comics Coast to Coast, because he's a high energy guy. Yeah. On that show, and it was kind of cool to kind of switch gears. And he even said on the show that that he wasn't sure about being on that side of the mic. Yeah, it was kind of funny.
Yeah, the dynamic was really good, and just his natural way of seeing the world created a lot of good conversation.
Yeah, I was impressed with his take on Game of Thrones and similar to you, actually. And we're going to get into this in just a second. But for those of you that don't know, Hammond has caught up on the entirety of Game of Thrones to be on the show during the Winter's Coming segment. So Brian did the same thing, but over the course of this year. I think you've been doing it over, what, 6 weeks?
I started the 1st of April.
Wow, so like a month.
Yeah, I did the whole thing in less than a month.
That's like a season a week. That's work. Yeah. there's some serious effort going into that. Well, I don't want to get into that too soon, because I want to kind of put it all together with, you know, when we're talking about Game of Thrones. Plus, I want to make sure that I give everybody ample spoiler warning and stuff like that. But the other thing that's coming your way after the show, after the credits tonight, last night I saw The Avengers. Alistair McFly, who's been on the show before, has also seen the show, or seen the movie. Hammond has also seen Avengers. So after the credits on tonight's episode, we're going to have a little kind of 10 to 15 minute powwow, a little bit of spoilers. We're going to do our best not to get into too much detail, but we just want to warn everybody that you can't really talk about the movie without spoiling it, because, I mean, it's so fresh in theaters. So after the credits tonight, Alistair, Hammond, and I are going to hang out and talk about Avengers. But spoiler free, it was holy shit awesome. That's all I'm going to say.
It was not my favorite Marvel Cinematic Universe film, but it's very, very, very good.
Yeah.
And it really does fill their Empire Strikes Back kind of role.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I've had several nerds that I respect compare it to that on podcasts. Spoiler free, just kind of playing like that's kind of the realm it lays in. I'm just like, perfect. I'm in there.
A little darker, a little more of an ambiguous ending.
Yep.
Some new characters thrown into the mix. I mean, it almost ticks all the boxes of Empire Strikes Back, almost way to go, except no one ended up in carbonite.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a spoiler, no carbonite. I'm going to say let's wait until the end. Cause I can feel myself wanting to talk about it, and I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
But the other thing I do want to make a quick mention of, something that I've been watching on Netflix, which I cannot in good conscience, not mention on the show, Planet Earth, the BBC documentary series about our planet, is on Netflix. It's in full 1080p HD. It's narrated by David Attenborough, and it is beautiful. I'll talk about it some other time when I'm all finished, but I mean, you just do yourself a favor and watch it.
So we watched this one as in first run on Discovery Channel, and the US version of it has Sigourney Weaver as the narrator.
Oh.
And we watched it in first run. It was one of the first things we watched when we got a brand new HD TV. HD was kind of the reason we bought an HD TV.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not just talking in hyperbole. This is a visual smorgasbord to behold. I'm not even kidding. Put on your HD, watch it.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely beautiful. I'm not sure. I think I would probably enjoy Sigourney Weaver as a narrator, but I'm surprised that there's two different versions. It's kind of strange.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize it was the same thing, but it's Sigourney Weaver does the US version.
Yeah. Do you get the other BBC nature shows? Because the BBC documentaries on nature stuff by David Attenborough are just, they're all stunning. They're all amazing.
I'm aware of them, but since we don't have cable, it's... I have to really look for them.
Yeah, they're not on Netflix for you guys?
Well, I'm sure they are. I just, like I said, I have to look for them. And
yeah.
Right now, nature documentaries is not where I'm spending my Netflix time.
No, that's true. One thing I like about Netflix, at least how it's worked for me so far in Canada, is that once I watched one, it was very easy to find the others. They start getting recommended to you in the documentary section.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I made the mistake of watching a documentary about the secret alien moon mission where they found the body. And now I'm getting crazy, you know, insane paranoid documentaries, which I need to somehow fix.
Hmm.
What you watch when you're recovering from a shoulder surgery sometimes is not what you watch normally.
Yeah.
And I'm paying the price.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that issue too with, some, like when you've got multiple people in the household and you've got different, like you have to have different accounts sometimes, otherwise it just recommends really weird stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that, I had to tell mom how to do that because there's grandkids, with stepsisters and stuff. And if they're watching a lot of kiddie programming, their Netflix stuff is all going to be goop and they need to make sure that they separate that stuff out. The one thing that I wanted to ask you, and I don't know why I didn't lead with this, you were on a crazy cool vacation in Hawaii while you were away.
Yeah, from April 1st to April 11th, we were on the island of Oahu.
Wow, 10 days.
I had not been there since I graduated from high school in 1988. And it was kind of strange going back because so much had changed. And then on the other hand, so much had not. And
wow, wait a minute. So you're from Hawaii?
No, my dad was military. And so he was stationed there.
Right.
For my last 2 years of high school.
Oh, very cool. That would be a really cool place to go to high school.
It was okay. It was, you know, when you want to spread your wings a little bit when you get your driver's license and just drive around. And in Hawaii, depending on traffic, you could end up right back where you started in about 2.5-3 hours. So,
yeah. Yeah.
But
it
was fun to go back. It was super relaxing. We stayed at the Alani, which is the Disney resort, for a few days, and the kids got to run around and do that. We just got to spend time at the beach and the pool, and it was just fun and nice and relaxing. I sat next to the water for 2 or 3 days and read and listened to music. And
nice.
I mean, it was just super, super relaxing. In the mornings, we had enough time, and we weren't really rushed.
Hmm.
So I'd wake up early because I didn't really ever adjust to the time change. So I was waking up at like 3 or 4 in the morning.
Ooh.
And I'd go for a walk for a while and then come back and watch a couple episodes of Game of Thrones, like seasons 1 and 2 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everyone would start waking up and we'd have breakfast and then go down to the pool and the beach. And then in the evenings, I'd play a couple games of Hearthstone and then go to bed.
Right on. Sounds like a great vacation. Like I think even I would, I don't necessarily think that I would set an alarm, but I mean, if I woke up before the sun and I was on vacation in Hawaii, I would probably take advantage and get up and go to the beach or just kind of explore as opposed to just like roll over and go back to sleep, you know?
Yeah, no, it was great. I'd wake up and I'd go walking for a couple hours and then get back and everyone's starting to stir. So
yeah. I need a vacation and I need one where I'm doing a whole lot of nothing.
Yep. And that's what this was. The location was the vacation. It wasn't like going to Florida and then
Disney World or something.
Exhausted
by the end of your day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This was really one of those kick your feet up in the shade and enjoy the time that you're not doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Peyton, who one of the people that helped me start this podcast, his wife Lee, is adamant about two different kinds of vacation a year. You know, there's the one where you go and do something or you're going and I mean something that's sometimes that's visiting family, but it's kind of going. You're accomplishing something and you've got something to do. Maybe you're going on a vacation where you're hiking or exploring or visiting a country you've never been. And then there are the ones where you just pay X amount of money to go sit on a cruise ship and just you don't have a plan. You wake up, you do whatever the hell you feel like, and then you go to bed. And you do that for like 5 or 6 days. And, you know, those are the kind of recharge vacations that everybody needs, especially with so much going on. I feel like everybody these days is just super busy with all kinds of stuff, you know, whether it's volunteering or, you know, whether your full-time job bleeds over into extra hours or hobbies, things that keep people up late at night. I am finding more and more and more that I have to schedule time for friends, like weeks in advance. Gone are the days of me just calling up buddies and like, what are you doing? Want to go see a movie? All right, let's go. Like that doesn't happen.
And you're single.
Yeah.
And no kids. And it gets even harder when you have kids because then you have to worry about babysitters or you're going to include them.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of it is that most of my friends are either in significant relationships or married with kids. So there's always somebody else to think about and other things going on and maybe they've got plans already because they're having dinner with another couple. Like the amount of things that people have to do adds up. And if the kids are school age and there's like soccer practice and stuff, forget it. Like it's just, I'll see you at Christmas and weekends on, you know, in the summer and stuff like that. I mean, it's a little bit easier. I have to say, it's a little bit easier in the summer.
It is.
Because usually sports and, or not sports, but like after school stuff is over and school is over. So there's less of a schedule. And there's more of a like, oh, we can take the kid and go to the beach for 3 hours. Like, that's something that you can do kind of in the middle of the day.
And everyone gets can stay up later.
Yeah. So yes. Yeah.
Those nights where you want to have, like, if we invite people over, then the kids can stay up while we play cards or,
right.
You
it's
know, whatever.
Not the end of the world if the kid's up till 10 o'clock at night because, like, well, whatever. He can just sleep in the next day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you had a good time on the vacation. And this was a big kind of a family reunion thing?
It was a huge vacation. My brother and sister-in-law and their two kids went, and then my wife's mom and dad went, and then my wife and our two kids went. And it was just, you know, family hanging out, having fun.
Nice. Very, very cool. Right on. Well, let's not waste any more of this precious podcast and get into Game of Thrones. And there's a reason why I want to devote some extra time to this week. And that is, of course, that you've got, I want to know your impressions of like the first four seasons. So before we go any further, I'll let everybody know this is going to be full of spoilers, folks. This is, normally we focus just on the current season and we will be talking about episode 4, Sons of the Harpy from season 5 in depth tonight. But Hammond. Let's talk about Peyton. Hammond has watched seasons 1 through 4, as well as the first 4 episodes of the season. So dude, like what's your initial kind of impression? Like, are you dragging your feet? Are you hating it? Like, are you in love with the show? Like the rest of the planet? Like what's the Chamberlain gavel saying about Game of Thrones?
I very much like it. And it took me a while to realize that it, at its essence, it's a political thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Absolutely.
It just happens to be set into this in this fantasy world.
Yeah, it's like Lord of the Rings meets Sopranos.
I was going to say it's like Lord of the Rings meets House of Cards.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's very, very much a story of power.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, though, I really do believe that George R.R. Martin could be writing for the WWE. The good guys flip. The bad guys do good things. There are heel turns. There's baby faces. There are just all kinds of good people doing bad things for good reasons and bad people doing bad things for worse reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and the Red Wedding are all the same thing because all they do is reset who's aligned with whom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's all a bad thing, but it makes it very hard to find characters to attach yourself to.
Hmm.
As a viewer, and I'm okay with that because I can always root for Arya. Is that
Arya? Right? Yep.
Yeah, I can always root for Arya. I feel like I'm, even though Jaime is kind of a despicable person, I kind of can root for him.
Mm-hmm.
Since his hand incident, he's kind of turned into a different person. The one that was the most shocking for me was the Hound. Because instead of the Hound going through and living up to the stereotype of just being this ruthless jerk, he ended up kind of being an okay guy.
Yeah, he was ruthless because he had to be.
Yeah.
I think to survive in King's Landing in the position he was in, I feel like he had to be ruthless and he had to live up in action to the rumors because the rumors were, it's what kept him alive was mostly fear. People would just get out of his way because they thought, oh crap, here comes the Hound. And so he had to kind of act out in order to maintain that level of fear. Whereas if people realized he didn't really give a shit about anything, you know, he would fight if he had to, but he wasn't really going to go out of his way. People would have walked all over him.
Yeah. That whole thing was very interesting. My favorite episode to date is the Battle of the Wall.
Battle of the Wall. Oh, the wall in the north.
Yes.
Night's Watch. Yeah.
Yeah. That is my favorite episode to date. And it was one of those cleansing moments. It was one of those resets like WrestleMania. And I bet you if I tried hard enough, if I could draw lines, you know, Jon Snow is John Cena. I mean, I could do that if you made me.
That's awesome. Jon Snow is John Cena. I've never compared. See, I don't watch wrestling anymore, so I don't really, you know, the only wrestler I keep up with is The Rock, and it's only because he's in like 5 movies a year and he's a monster on social media and I find him very entertaining. But beyond that, I don't keep up with anybody else.
But the lines, and I don't really follow very much either. I go to an independent wrestling promotion here in town once a month because my nephew and my father-in-law and I like going. But the way the stories are told are very, very similar. And I'm it's not a bad thing. It just, it's one of those things. I mean, that's why I think why it's popular is because as soon as you get comfortable knowing something, it changes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like they do a lot of really good setup to make you feel comfortable. And despite the fact that they teach you a hard lesson in season one, when Ned Stark dies, that you're not prepared for other people when they go.
I wasn't surprised because I think it's in Sean Bean's contract that he dies early on in every story
yeah,
he's in.
Yeah.
I mean, he was killed by in Equilibrium early. I mean, everything he's in, he seems to die very, very early in.
Yeah, it's a bit of a running joke, I guess, with his career. But I feel like there was the marketing of season one really kind of put him in kind of like the Aragorn shoes. Like he looked like he was going to be the father figure, the leader, the hero. And for him not to make it through the first season, I thought was really kind of telling. And I mean, I used to compare Game of Thrones to Battlestar Galactica when you were never sure who was going to be a Cylon or who was going to die. I really enjoy shows where people that are main characters or people in the credits would be a better, like Battlestar Galactica, you know, there would be those opening credits and they would show people's names on the screen. And just because their names were in the first, you know, 30 seconds of the credits did not mean that they were necessarily safe. Normally in network television, that's kind of a bank that those people are not going to die unless it's the season finale. Like there's usually some big two-parter event when somebody leaves a show. But in Game of Thrones, it could be just, episode two of whatever season.
And I'm convinced that Peter Dinklage's character, is that Tyrion?
Yes, it is.
He is the most resilient character in the entire story. And the only reason I say that is because he's been able to weather all the storms almost unfazed. He is still who he was in season one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody else has been altered in some way by the events of the last four seasons.
Yeah.
He still is kind of the womanizing drunk.
Yeah. You must see some really cool growth, like Jon, you know, and Daenerys.
Oh, yeah. When you pound through them like I did, there isn't that waiting. And so you kind of don't. It's all still really, really fresh in your head. So John's growth as a member of the Night's Watch is actually really amazing.
Mm. Yeah, and he's one of my favorite characters.
And they question him about his oath and his loyalties and stuff. But wasn't he kind of under orders to behave in the order in the way he did while he was over the wall?
Yes.
Shouldn't he be given a pass for that kind of stuff?
Well, the person that gave him those orders died before he was able to tell everybody else.
Yeah, that's right.
It was his uncle, I think, wasn't it?
I don't remember
his name. He had a very distinct nose. That's all I remember about the actor. He had long black hair and a very distinct nose. He looked like a crow. He passed away before because he told John to like completely embrace his role as a spy and be as convincing as possible. And then like John convinced himself so well that he ended up falling for Ygritte, right?
Yeah.
So she would be one of my least favorite characters, you know, both in the book and in the TV show. I didn't really enjoy her at all. Does anybody stick out that you, either didn't like because you didn't like the portrayal or people that you didn't like just cause they were so good at making your skin crawl?
To be really honest, I got really, really tired of, Lady Stark. For whatever reason, she always just seemed so cold. And even when she was supposedly being affectionate, she just seemed to be kind of going through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this sneaking suspicion that Sansa is going to make Cersei, when she grows up, look like a member of the Sesame Street cast. Because I think Sansa is on the verge of becoming a true psychotic.
Yeah, she's had a flip in the last season, in mid last season or about two-thirds of the way through last season, there was a change where, and I think it's tied to when she kind of realizes her power as a woman in the situation that they're in. women in this particular world don't have a great deal of power, at least not like frontward facing. They tend to be more, they tend to have to manipulate, be more political, use their, basically their sexuality to their advantage, you know, in a lot of ways. I think that she's sort of realizing, oh, wait a minute, I'm a very attractive young woman and I can kind of use this to my advantage. Obviously, I've got Baelish wrapped around my finger. Or at least that's how she thinks she does. Like, I don't want her to get overconfident. That's my concern with Sansa, is that I don't want her to get overconfident. But, and I think a lot of it too is like the, in the current season, she, her hair is dyed to, you know, kind of conceal her identity as best they could. And, I think it makes her look harsher.
Yes.
Right. I mean, she's so pale anyway, cause she's a redhead, but then on top of that, now she's got this black hair and I find her very, what's the word I'm looking for? She doesn't really twitch that much. Like, I mean, something bad happens and she's just kind of got this cold look on her face. Like something's, she's planning something. She revealed a little bit of it this week and we'll get into that a little bit later in the conversation. But, you know, you can sort of see the wheels turning, I guess is the best way to describe Sansa right now.
Like I said, I feel like she's just, once she has a little bit of power and a little bit of freedom, I have a feeling she's going to lay waste to everyone that's ever wronged her. And the difference between her and her sister is her sister's going to do it with her own hands, and it's going to be very targeted. I think Sansa's just going to be like a nuclear bomb when she does it and just wipe out entire groups of people without blinking.
Yeah, well, you know, with the unifying the North, or, you know, having the control of Winterfell, or having some sort of army behind her and have her, you know, at her whim and seeing what that kind of mess. I mean,
even her fiancé is a raging psychopath.
Oh, yeah.
So all she needs to do is unleash him on a group of people.
Right. Yeah. Now, I mean, there's the theory is that they're not going to really last. You know, the Baelish seems to think that Baratheon is going to come down, and Stannis is going to come down and capture Winterfell and defeat them anyway. I'm not sure who Baelish thinks that Sansa is going to marry. Like, I'm not sure who, you know, he called her the Wardeness of the North or something. Yeah. I don't remember the exact quote, but I'm not sure who her husband is supposed to be. Because even if, and like, unless you're widowed, like even if you're the sole surviving heir to Winterfell, I feel like in this particular world, you still need kind of a husband at your side. It's awful. I mean, I don't even feel right saying it, obviously, you know, in 2015, but in Game of Thrones, you know, you definitely have some more decisive power. If you have, kind of a power couple at the heart of a house. Like there's, you gain strength by having both people. And not to say that, you know, I think the other way would be true as well. Like if you were a lord and you had Winterfell, I feel like you would also benefit by having, you know, a strong wife who would then, you know, rouse the people. And like, there needs to be that balance in this world. And I think it's kind of needed on both, I guess, both edges of the sword. Is there anybody, like, what do you think about the fantasy in Game of Thrones? Like, is there enough of it for you?
I'm okay with the level that they have. They tease you with the dragons. They tease you with a little bit of magic.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be increasing as the seasons progress. Like they introduced the Red Witch and the Smoke Assassin guy and
the White Walkers and stuff.
Yeah, that was at the beginning, but it was never played up very much. But that the end of what was it?
I think it was the end of season two.
Or was it three? Sam's out there and he sees the zombie people walking around.
That was season three, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, wow, we're moving into, you know, the Night's Watch versus The Walking Dead, and it didn't feel like they were just lifting it. It felt like it was its own creation because they had the horse and the guy, and then, you know, the whole thing was very well constructed.
Yeah,
I think the level of fantasy is fine. I think that is used to create story elements where everybody has to kind of get together again. Again, it's one of those moments where you have to realign, because kind of like if the planet Earth were attacked by aliens, everybody would be on the same side because we're defending the Earth instead of fighting each other. It's the same kind of thing. When those guys come over the wall, all of a sudden, all this stuff that's going on right now is going to be forgotten because they have to defend against this other bigger thing.
Yeah. And I think the only thing that I think they could have done better is explaining the difference and making a clearer difference between whites and the White Walkers. The whites would have been the guys with the blue eyes and the white skin that come back to life in like seasons 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then the White Walkers are the guys that look like frozen tree bark.
Yeah.
Like they're very ethereal looking. There was a guy with a baby at the end of last season, I think.
Uh-huh.
And he was obviously, Craster was giving babies and that's how they make new whites new White Walkers, because the whites are just the dead. They're the kind of like the zombies of the crowd. Whereas the whites seem to be more intelligent and calculating and stuff like that. The books are very good at describing all the different animals and stuff that are like undead, frozen lich animals. That's such a cool event in the book when they reveal that.
You just said something very interesting. So you said that their skin looks like tree bark.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, and they've done in the north, they pray to that tree with the face.
Yeah, the godswood, yeah.
Yeah, are the White Walkers the gods that they might be praying to?
I don't think so. The trees...
I'm just kind of pulling because all of a sudden you're like, hey, you pray to effigies, and so therefore an effigy would be...
Yeah.
If he looks like a tree and you're going to pray to a tree, then when dude shows up and looks like a tree, hey...
Yeah, I think if I was to hazard a guess, and I don't know, I feel like the fact that the people of the North that are praying to the godswood, I don't remember the name of the gods that they pray to. There is a name,
okay.
But I'm not remembering it. And it's not like a person or a single representative. It's like... It's like the Norse gods or something. There's it's like okay. A group. It's a population of a deity. It's kind of ambiguous that way.
Okay. I was just actually trying to.
But the faces in the godswood are. I mean, the godswoods are specific kinds of trees, and they're rare. And the faces are carved into them by people. It's not like they show up that way.
Okay.
Yeah. However, what I think that the godswood and those deities are closer related to are the green seers, which is what Bran seems to be on his route to becoming, or at least getting closer to. Green seers are the people that can do more than just control animals with their brain, but also control people and stuff like that. And there's more to it apparently, but I don't recall, and two, there hasn't been enough in the books that I've read so far to explain the full power of what a, you know, green seer at the peak of their magic could do. And that's where I feel like the godswoods are closer related to those guys, but that could be just me. But we can probably get into some more detail about the current season. I'm curious to hear what you think about this season so far, given how, I guess, eventful the other seasons have been. So we're going to talk about Sons of the Harpy. This is episode 4 of season 5. It was just aired a few days ago. Quick rundown. The Sparrows sees Loras Tyrell and Margaery is enraged, but Tommen proves too weak to arrange his release. Melisandre tries to seduce Jon Snow and attempt to convince him to come to Winterfell with Stannis. In the crypts of Winterfell, Baelish reveals he has been summoned to return to King's Landing by Cersei. Before leaving, he tries to dispel the misgivings of Sansa towards Ramsay Bolton, telling her that Stannis will defeat the Boltons when he arrives at Winterfell. Bronn and Jaime secretly arrive in Dorne, and they have to fight some horsemen that discover them. Alaria convinces the Sand Snakes to plan to avenge the death of Oberyn, who died last season when his head got smooshed, by abducting Myrcella. And then Ser Jorah plans to redeem himself by bringing Daenerys Tyrion, Hasdar Zolorak, man, these names, makes another appeal to Daenerys to reopen the fighting pits. And of course, in the last scene, the Sons of Harpy run amok and ambush patrolling Unsullied inside the Citadel and start massacring soldiers. Grey Worm and Ser Barristan are among the people in the fight. So that's kind of the big... kind of cliffhanger at the end of this particular episode was the Sons of the Harpy, which of course where the episode got its name. Where do you want to start? At the beginning with Marjorie and Tommen? Like this, I found this very interesting.
Yeah, you actually broke it down into pretty good outlines. Let's just follow yours.
Yeah, I try to kind of stick with either locations or kind of pairs of people. It helps me kind of keep things straight for starters, because as you heard, there's a lot of different names to keep straight, especially now that we're in Dorne and you've got even new characters this season or people that were barely introduced last season. You don't really know. So with Marjorie and Tommen, we're getting to know them. And last week I spoke about how much I really enjoyed the happy moments that they were having together. Everybody really likes Tommen. Like, he's a very likable, I guess, 14 or 15 year old. Unfortunately, he's still a kid and he doesn't really have the stones to do the things that he needs to do. And he's still being bullied by his mom in the shadows. And that kind of bothered me. I was really hoping that Tommen was going to surprise Cersei and somehow find a way to free his queen's brother, you know, and just kind of be a little bit more kingly. Maybe I was wishing for it a little bit too soon. They did just get married last episode. I might have to wait a few more weeks to see something a little bit more kingly from Tommen. But I found that Marjorie was kind of playing, like showing her hand a lot about trying to get Tommen to do what she wanted, and then sort of having a tantrum when he didn't do it.
Yeah. I feel like Tommen's going to be a victim of Cersei and Marjorie. I feel like he's just caught in the middle and he's going to end up getting pulled between a dangerous mom and someone who's proving to be increasingly dangerous in Marjorie.
Right. I mean, neither one of them have any ill will towards Tommen, because obviously Cersei wants to keep her last, you know, child that she has in, you know, she's got control over what happens to him to an extent. She wants to protect him. And as long as he's in power, she's also in power as far as, you know, the small council goes. Obviously, Marjorie doesn't want anything to happen to him. As long as he's alive, she's the queen. I mean, she is where she wanted to be.
And I think she's alive as long as he's alive. That's a key point, too, because I think if Tommen, something were to happen to Tommen, Marjorie would be gone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, instantly. The fact that he's alive and would kind of avenge and is so, like, he's so smitten by her that, I mean, if anything was to happen to her, he would find out who did it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I feel like Tommen is starting to see what his mother's really like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's getting to an age where I think he can sort of glimpse that. Despite the fact that Cersei is always on her best behavior when she's around him. But I'm curious to see where it's going to go. I was hoping for a little bit more from Marjorie. Like, I was hoping for a little bit more subtle manipulation as opposed to just like stomping out of the room.
Yeah.
That was frustrating, I think.
But I agree with your sister that Cersei's clock is ticking and that she's going to end up pulling a string too hard and it's going to snap on her.
Well, she's playing with some fire. I mean, like, something that I find in any show really kind of bothers me is any kind of like religious zealots, fanaticism. It's a scary thing, and because it relates to so many things that are happening in the world right now, and you know, having these sparrows, which are essentially just, you know, extremists in the sept, going after Loras because he's homosexual, like it echoes across a lot of, you know, current events and sensitivities in media and all this kind of stuff, and you just, you know, again, like, you know, my 2015 sensibilities are just like, you just, God, guys are so freaking clueless. And, you know, like, here you are murdering people in the streets, yet you're pious and, you know, holier than thou bullshit. Like, it drives me nuts. And Cersei is the one aiming them. And if, like, once that's found out, I really feel like it's going to be a shit show.
Yeah. I also am very interested in the fact that the parallels between the two cities, what's going on in Marine and King's Landing, that can't be an accident. The parallels are too thick between the two groups of people and the uprising and the violence
right,
for it to be an accident as so far as storytelling goes.
Yeah, you're talking about like the Sons of the Harpy and the Sparrows.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I feel like the Sons of Harpies, I don't know if they're necessarily, I wouldn't call them religious extremists. I would say they're more like terrorists.
But that's potato potato.
Yeah, well, in some way. Okay. Well, but I guess the only difference being is that there's no religious belief driving what they're doing. They're just killing soldiers because they want to maintain slavery. Like they want to overthrow Daenerys because they want the old ways of the city to return.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with Daenerys being, you know, worshiping a different god or something like that. Like
the parallels between the fanatical uprising are really strong. And as a storyteller, there has to be some sort of payoff at some point for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think too that there's a certain, I don't want to say predictability, but there's a certain pattern, I guess, to human behavior. Right. And when you get these extremes where a city's been overthrown or a throne has been overthrown, ultimately there's going to be some sort of tension. And I feel like in King's Landing right now, like people, they don't want Tommen in there. There's rumors that he's a bastard. There's, you know, they're not really comfortable with who is technically the king. They're not praising him as... I mean, not that I was sure that they were praising the like Baratheon, but they certainly didn't like Joffrey. So, I mean, the Lannisters as rulers in King's Landing are on a short thread. And it's the same sort of thread that Daenerys is on, you know? And it's like King's Landing is crumbling from within. And then Meereen, I'm not sure. Maybe it is crumbling. Maybe they're the same. I thought it was going to be more from the outside, but... I think it's because Meereen had such a strong military takeover, whereas King's Landing, the Lannisters had, or Joffrey, because technically everybody thinks they're Baratheons, but the rulers of King's Landing have been there longer.
Yeah.
Right? And so maybe what we're seeing is just like different stages of the same situation.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's hard to.
And the reason I brought it up is because as soon as the episode was over, the first thing I thought of was the fact that they're pretty much the same things are happening, just for different reasons and different stages.
Mm. Yeah, I'm curious to see if I feel like Daenerys is going to be better equipped to fix it though.
I think so too. Because she has a less. Self-invested mindset.
Mm.
Like the Lannisters are all about themselves.
Right.
I mean, that's all they care about. But Daenerys seems to be actually thinking about the greater picture, whether it be the greater good or the greater bad or whatever. She seems to be thinking about bigger pictures.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Well, let's move north and talk about Jon Snow and Stannis. A couple of really interesting scenes here. Both kind of illustrating good qualities about Jon and Stannis. I really, really enjoyed the scene with Stannis and Shireen, where he, I think for the first time, tells his daughter that it was his fault that she got grayscale, or he blames himself for this doll that came across from a merchant that obviously had the disease with it. And then he called in all the maesters he could to save her, and she ends up, you know, kind of falling into his arms and giving him this great big hug. And they've never been a very loving family as far as being on screen, and I thought it was really cool to see, because I don't like Stannis, but it was cool to see a softer side of him. But they did it in a very measured way. They didn't just gonna go all CW mushy on you, you know, all of a sudden he's like the loving, doting dad. It was hard for him to say it, and it was even harder for him to hug her.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought they did that very well.
Okay. Having pounded through as many episodes as I have,
right,
the father-daughter relationship theme is something that comes up constantly in this series. There's the Ned and his two daughters. There's Jaime and his quest to save his daughter. There's the Hound and Arya. Arya and the Faceless Man. Little Worm and Sansa. Cersei and her dad. The Greyjoy daughter and her dad. This example here... That father-daughter relationship is something that is explored in so many different ways throughout the series. And I don't know if I would have noticed it as glaringly if I had not watched 40-plus hours of it in a month.
Yeah, something like that, I feel like, would just kind of smack you over the head. And that, I mean, like it is to me now. Like, now that you mention it, you're absolutely right. I would feel that Arya and Ned Stark was a stronger bond than Sansa. Sansa and Ned, I felt like, was a little bit more of a... I don't understand this teenage kid.
Yes, versus... but his death has affected her and changed the way she sees the world.
True. Yeah. Very true.
I mean, he still has an effect on her, even though he wasn't around to actually have a physical hand in it. But they tend to, it's very interesting how they redefine that kind of relationship over and over and over again throughout the way the story is being told.
I'm curious to see how they're going to develop the relationship then between Jamie and Marcella then.
And that, it's something I'm looking forward to seeing. As soon as I saw this, I started thinking of all the different ways that this could pan out. I mean.
Yeah. Because all the first sons are missing.
Yeah.
Like Rob is gone. Joffrey's gone. Who else? What's his face there? Greyjoy. Theon. He's not, he's not dead, but he might as well be.
I have my doubts that he's as brainwashed as he's letting on. Mm. I think he's doing it for survival, and when the opportunity comes, he might not be quite as gone as we think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's obviously missing some parts, though.
Yes, yes, yes. He's.
I feel like
He's not who he used to be.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. There's two things in the books that really, really irked me. The whole Theon Greyjoy thing. That was really disturbing to read. And, oh gosh, there was one other thing on the tip of my tongue, and I can't remember what it was now.
Well, the way it was portrayed on the TV show, it's almost like a chapter out of American Psycho. I mean, it was rough.
Yeah, it goes on for a lot longer in the books. It's a lot more drug out, and you feel the mental, like, switch. Like, you can feel the breaking. There was something else that in the books that was a lot longer that you had mentioned tonight. I'm trying to remember what it was. I'm sure it'll come back to me. But there was something that I felt was done better in the books in terms of like explaining the relationship, or you got a little bit more out of it in the books than you did in the TV show. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens now with Jon Snow at the Wall, because in addition to seeing some, you know, the softer side of Stannis, we're seeing a more resilient side of Jon Snow, where Melisandre basically strips and sits on him and says, "Hey, together we can be power," and tries to convince him to come to Winterfell with her and Stannis, and he resists. And I have to say, and I've noticed this a couple times, especially looking up actors and stuff, like kind of off season. I don't look up people when I'm watching because I don't want to find out, oh, hey, they were only in 5 episodes this season. I'm like, well, crap. I don't want to spoil people dying ahead of time. But in between seasons, it's always kind of cool to see what they're doing, like what other shows they might be on. And the actress that plays Melisandre is a very attractive woman. She's very creepy in the show. It's hard to kind of flip back and forth, but she's a very attractive woman. And then she's also really, really dark, and it gets under your skin. Like when she leaves the room after John shuts her down and says, "You know nothing, Jon Snow," like my ears kind of went, "Whoa, what?" That's not what you're supposed to say. How did you know that? Yeah, it's there's some dark, shadowy things happening, pun intended, from season 2 or season 3.
Yes, yes, yeah. That was one of the more disturbing scenes in the entire run for me, is the birth of the smoke assassin.
Smoke assassin? Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. That was disturbing. Because they showed so much of the event, and they showed I feel like what sold it was Davos, the Onion Knight, his reaction.
Yeah.
Like it would have been the first time he'd seen magic, period. You know, he still couldn't explain what he saw, and I think that was really telling.
Oh, and the other kind of father-daughter relationship, and it kind of is a stretch, but is the Brienne and her squire.
Oh yeah. Yes,
yeah. The genders are flipped, but it's still very much a, for lack of a better term, father-daughter relationship.
Yeah,
because well, she's going to teach him how to fight.
Yeah,
she's going to. I mean, it's the same sort of kind of thing. It's just the genders are flipped.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And it was a little bit different with Ned and Arya too. I mean, she wasn't a little lady. Like, she wanted to learn how to sword fight and all that kind of stuff. So it was almost like, I mean, there's almost some father-son going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. It really, of all the themes that have jumped out in the show, that one is the one that's got me the biggest.
Yeah. And you know what? Now that you mention it, Ser Barristan and Daenerys.
Yeah.
right? Yep. I mean, he's he's older than, I mean, Jorah Mormont, there was almost like kind of like a little bit of a romance going on there.
That was pretty one-sided, I think.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But it was, but still not parental.
Yeah. Like they dated for 3 years, but she didn't know it.
Yeah. 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 Very accurate. But Barristan is, you know, white haired, white beard, has that kind of wise sage, told her stories about her brother, who she was too young to know, all that kind of stuff. And true to form with this show, I hope they don't fall into this pattern, but they do remind you about how much you like somebody before they put them in harm's way. And the story, the conversation that Daenerys is having with Ser Barristan right before, he gets into this fight and we don't know what happens because the episode ends, with the Sons of the Harpy, is a very happy, they're laughing. He's telling stories about her brother Rhaegar, singing as a minstrel and donating the funds that he would get to the poor or the next minstrel down the street. And she's just kind of captivated by the story. Like it's a very father-daughter relationship or moment, like you've been saying. And then we don't know, you know, whether he's alive or not. Same with Grey Worm, who's also got a special relationship with Daenerys, in the fact that he's kind of the leader of the Unsullied, kind of her chief, or one of her chief, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess I would say he's probably part of the small council in terms of like the military, her military might. He would be probably one of her chief advisors.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
Yeah. But I was disappointed with that scene. Not in the show, just it was one of those moments that I'm sure you're probably used to now, where you're like, Martin, what have you done? You know,
to draw the WWE, he's holding up the belt and basking in the glory, and the guy's going to come up behind him and hit him with a chair.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. That's the Red Wedding was the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I mean, I don't really have a lot to say about this particular episode. The only thing that I can close on is right where we left off with Tyrion and Varys and their verbal sparring, we picked up with Jaime and Bronn. I enjoy the fact that every episode this season has had some sort of laughter and comic relief, because otherwise the show is, one, pretty slow this season, and two, dark. Yeah. And I really appreciate the lighter moments. It's not a lot. It's, you know, just enough to kind of keep a few smiles happening during an episode. And I had a good couple of chuckles with Jaime and Bronn.
Yeah, the only things I need to wrap up on is the fact that, why hasn't Jaime thought of using his hand as a shield or a weapon before?
Yeah.
I mean, because that's great.
Yeah,
he can do all kinds of neat stuff with a gilded bunch of digits.
Yeah, well, and I'm not, well, I mean, with when you put the glove over it, of course the other guy doesn't realize it's not a real hand. And what I'm surprised is that he's using a hand. Like, why doesn't he have like a hook
or a knife
or a shield, or like, why doesn't he have something strapped to it, you know, for when, I mean, I can appreciate now he's kind of incognito, like he's kind of going undercover, and that would be kind of pretty conspicuous to have a giant knife kind of strapped to your arm. But, you know, like, why doesn't he have like go-go gadget sword, you know, when he goes into battle? You know, it would make a lot more sense, because a lot of times guys would use like a dagger in the offhand, you know, and then have a sword.
That's what Bronn does. Bronn's all about carrying two or three weapons on him.
Yeah. Bronn's all about staying alive.
Yeah.
Is what that guy's all about.
And the other thing I want to throw out real quick, too, is that I was kind of shocked at how fast Tyrion was able to use his Batman CSI skills to figure out who his captor was.
Yeah.
That was really rushed. And I felt as if they could have given us a little bit more time with that to let the deductive reasoning sink in.
Yeah.
Because as it was, he was like, oh, here's your stuff, and here's your stuff, and I know exactly who you are.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for the, you know, the Who to start playing a song, and for, you know, the CSI theme to kick
CSI
in
theme.
Because it was just too fast, and it wasn't paced well as far as the realization of who it was.
Yeah, kind of waiting for Tyrion to look at his armor and say, like, can you enhance that a little bit?
Yeah, enhance, zoom.
zoom in. Can we get a clear picture on that? Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It felt very Sherlock Holmesy. Very, yeah. I'm gonna tell you everything that you already know, sort of stuff. And just, and I mean, it was clearly for the audience. Like it was, you know, that was the only way. It's one of the things that in the books that would have happened in his head, and he wouldn't have necessarily called him out on it.
Yeah,
right. And you still need the information, but you get it internally.
Yeah, and it would have saved him from getting punched too.
Yeah, yeah. Although that's kind of his MO right now.
Yeah,
yeah.
He kind of is the traveling punching bag. Everyone's taking shots at him.
Yeah. Well, that's it, folks. We're going to wrap up with the Internet Minute, which is brought to you, of course, by Tweaked Audio. You can visit tweakedaudio.com for high-performance noise-reducing earbuds. Use the code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. And my internet pick is going to spiral us into some preparation for Avengers. And this is the Avengers Reimagined by artist Daniel Kamarudin. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correct, Daniel. This artist, it was part of Tumblr. It was a DeviantArt Tumblr page that I found. And I'll also have a link in the show notes to his DeviantArt page, because Daniel's on DeviantArt. And he has reimagined the Avengers kind of like as medieval, I'm not sure what to call them, archetypes. So Iron Man is like an iron fire mage, I guess. The Hulk looks kind of like a giant Norse, not a god, but like a Norse warrior. Thor is obviously like a lightning god. Black Widow kind of looks like a, what would you call her, Hammond?
Oh, hang on, let me pull it up. I'm sorry.
She's kind of a rogue. She looks like a rogue. Is basically how it rolls. And I mean, he's a talented painter. Very, very cool stuff. Captain America, of course, is a knight with a round shield. Scarlet Witch and Vision are all in there. They're definitely worth checking out. And check out some of the other work that he's got going on, too. His DeviantArt handle is the DuRIIN.
Okay, his Hawkeye is my favorite.
Yes. Yeah, like he's done some very, very cool stuff. So if you're at all interested in seeing some different takes on superheroes, then check out Daniel Kamarudin.
Question is Hawkeye's my favorite.
It's super fun stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it for me. What's your pick this week, Hammond?
Well, I kind of struggled because when I first was going to go on this show and try to finagle some Game of Thrones talk, I downloaded the mixtape, Catch the Throne, and it's got a bunch of bands on there, and Mushroom Head's one of my favorite bands, and it's on there, and I was going to pick that. But then I discovered the Blue Man Group has done a cover of the Game of Thrones theme.
Oh, nice. Now,
I'm a huge fan of the Blue Man Group. I have been for years and years and years and years. And their take on it is kind of awe-inspiring because they're playing on their PVC instruments, and at the end, there's this huge kind of tribute to Hodor, and nice. It's great. And so I picked the Blue Man Group covering the Game of Thrones theme.
We've got the link in the show notes for that. I did not get a chance to listen before the show, but it is bookmarked and ready to rock for immediately thereafter. Oh, man. So that is it, folks. We're going to wrap up this week on the Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on the citadelcafe.com/live. Our mobile audio stream is provided by Alpha Geek Radio. Go to tunein.alphageekradio.com to find out how you can listen on your favorite device. For the Citadel Cafe, just choose Channel 1 at Showtime. Music for the show is composed by Kevin MacLeod, and the episode will be available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com. Email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything that I am up to online at joelduggan.com. A huge thank you to our 17 supporters on Patreon. This week is going to be Paul Duggan, my dad. Dad signed up to support us on Patreon, which I really appreciate. He also was the individual that pushed us to our first goal of $100 a month. So much appreciated, Dad. You can... Dad's not on Twitter. He's on Twitter. He doesn't read anything, so I can't plug anything that Dad does. He just kind of, you know, is. he's consuming as opposed to contributing. But but I really appreciate the support. That's patreon.com/Joel Duggan if you guys are interested in supporting the show. For as little as $1 a month, you can help support the Siddle Cafe, as well as Starcross, my webcomic. So you get a kind of a big bang for your buck, is the way that I like to look at it. The next milestone goal will involve a redesign of starcrossedonline.com, which will hopefully help me remove all of the web ads and become just a very crystal clear webcomic site for you guys. I called you Peyton again. I am sorry. I was talking to him earlier today, and I must have my friend Peyton on the brain. Hammond.
There are worse things to have on the brain. I suppose. Friends are good to think about.
Friends are good. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he should be flattered that I'm thinking about him when he's not here.
Or I should be flattered.
Or you should be angry, yeah. I guess.
No, yeah. I don't get angry.
I know. I like you both the same. So I can't pick favorites. Hammond, where can people find you and your awesome podcasts on the internet?
I am at Jay Hammond C on Twitter. I do a show called Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C. I interview creative folks. Joel has been a guest. And I just had an episode go up with a lady who was a voice on Sesame Street, and she was in the musical Avenue Q. I also do Grumpy Cast with Daryl Skeels, the Trek Nerd, and that comes out every couple weeks. And I make my monthly appearance here because Joel's nice enough to let me do it.
Yeah, and you'll be back again before the end of the season for Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Looking forward to that as well.
All this work is paying off.
And don't forget to stick around after the credits, folks. We're going to bring Alistair into the call, and we're going to talk about the Avengers Age of Ultron for a few minutes. Until then, you've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.
I'm good. How about yourselves?
Fantastic. Are you ready to talk some Avengers?
I am indeed.
I'm going to warn everybody. This is the post-credit section. We're going to spoil it. We don't have time to talk about the movie in crazy depth because there's Zombies Ate My Podcast is coming up after us. But I do want to warn everybody that because the movie has only been out for 3 days, it's impossible to talk about without spoiling some very cool moments. So if you have not seen it, best to come back a little bit later after you have taken in Age of Ultron. So I feel like I've been talking for an hour. So Alistair, what did you think? Where do you land?
I actually really liked it. I know there's been a bit of criticism about the direction, but I actually thought it made perfect sense.
I would agree. I don't understand the backlash. I thought it was a huge amount of fun.
Yeah, and I think it also got to the kind of point where They're looking at their roles, and they don't get that kind of holiday. They don't get to take breaks. And is this what they want to do with the rest of their lives?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a line in the movie where Tony Stark says, like, isn't the whole reason we fight is to just not have to fight anymore?
Exactly.
So we can all just go chill out.
Yeah, they're all looking for their way out kind of thing and to have that kind of break.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the reveal that Hawkeye was the stable family man.
Yes.
I thought that was brilliant. Really gave a lot of depth to a character and a lot of value to a character that a lot of people kind of struggle, you know, with. Like, sure, he's really cool and he's a badass spy, and so is, I guess, Black Widow, but neither one of them have any superpowers, right?
Exactly. Like, and if anything, it was... I mean, in the first movie, he spent most of his time possessed.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really any character development for him. So for him to have all of this, and for his partner to be saying that he is important to actually keep those guys together, to actually help ground them.
Yeah.
Just with the normalcy of humanity, in a way.
Yeah, and he's also, he's the glue without being the glue. Like, Captain America is the loud one, keeping everybody together. But Hawkeye is the brother that everybody not takes for granted, but doesn't realize how much support is being given.
Mm.
You know, that's how I kind of felt
and
about it.
And I love how much they're building up with this whole bickering between Captain America and Iron Man.
Yeah.
We saw it in the Avengers, and we're starting to see it continue even more. And obviously the next Captain America film is Captain America Civil War.
Right.
You know, they're both have the same end goal. But the way that they get there is completely different, and they are obviously finding it very hard to agree. And the way that they're portraying this is fantastic, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree too. Hammond, you were going to say?
I was just going to say that Hawkeye does have a superpower. It's the ability to procreate. Because he's been having kids when no one's looking.
Yeah. Yeah, there's what, three now, or as per the movie?
Yeah. He's a discreet lover.
Yeah.
Very discreet.
Never misses his mark, I guess. Sorry. That was kind of easy. I really enjoyed Ultron as well. I was surprised. I was expecting Big Evil Robot, and I got was Big Evil Robot with a personality. I didn't really expect him to be confused when he felt anger. I wasn't expecting him to be emotional. I was expecting him to be methodical. And I really thought it was interesting how they kind of, I mean, the trailer tells you that Iron Man and Stark and Banner create Ultron or unleash Ultron in one way. So that wasn't a giant spoiler in the trailer, but I thought it was very cool that it actually came from Loki's scepter.
Yes.
And then they developed that AI, and then it eventually kind of took shape. And you get this hint of the emotional instability when, in a digital illustration, he kills or disassembles Jarvis.
Mm.
And I thought it was very unique, because my concern going into this was that it was going to be the Avengers versus Terminator. Or Skynet, right? Like that's what I didn't want. Like, I wanted something more intelligent. I wanted something more, and I like how he wasn't just inherently evil. Like, he wasn't just like, you're all disgusting, I should exterminate you. It was like, no, I want to save the planet. Like, he has, again, the same goal as Iron Man and Captain America, but in a very extreme way and without any kind of attachment.
Yeah, he's not looking at saving humanity, he's looking at saving the planet.
Right.
So two completely different things. And I love that he was born out of Stark's fear of war.
Hmm.
You know, that was one thing that I thought was incredible. And when you were saying about the scepter, Loki's scepter, I think it also gave a lot more credibility to the technology that the Asgardians have.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just this magic stone that has all this magic ethereal stuff. It's, there is a technology behind it that's way beyond our understanding.
Yeah, well, and that's, I feel like it was in Thor, the original Thor movie. I feel like there's a line where someone says that, you know, when technology is advanced enough, it just appears as magic to people that don't understand it.
Yes.
Right, like I can't remember whether it was Thor or whether it was another Marvel movie, but one of the movies along the line has used that kind of reference, and I thought that was very cool.
I think it might have been in Captain America, and I think it might have been the Red Skull that said it.
No, you're right. I think you're right, Hammond. That's starting to ring a bell, especially with Hugo Weaving. Hugo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Weaver.
Yeah. I think it's Weaving. I can't remember. But yeah, I'm remembering the line now, and it's just some sort of off the cuff thing. He's just kind of like boasting his own intelligence to some minion that he's talking to. Or he's talking to the doctor, the guy that ends up being in a computer in the second Captain America. I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah.
But yeah. I one thing that I was pleased with too, I did not see it in 3D. I managed to see it in a regular theater. And for once it wasn't a tiny one in the corner. It was actually a really large theater. It was, the action in this movie was almost nonstop. You know, there was a couple of heart moments when they're talking, and some softer moments and some funny things happening here and there, but it really kind of revved up in the first 30 seconds and honestly didn't really slow down. There was no lulls.
My favorite part was the monologue that Iron Man had during the Hulkbuster fight. Because it was a monologue. It was a straight monologue. But it was humorous. It gave story. It did everything it was supposed to do. But it was he carried that scene basically looking into a camera with the CG overlay over his face.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed that fight scene. By the end of it, it sort of felt like it was maybe shoehorned in just to kind of get the Hulkbuster thing in there.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I mean,
you know,
I'd say kind of, but again, I think it's more to enforce Bruce. The fact that of all the heroes out there, and it's the wonderful line from Black Widow about how he's the one who doesn't want to fight because he knows he'll win.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it really sort of lays credence to just how strong and unstoppable he can be.
Yeah.
Especially as obviously he was being controlled at that point as well.
Yeah. I kind of wish they had gone darker with it. I wish they had shown. They didn't. You kind of have to assume that somebody somewhere in that fight died.
So you wanted to see the Hulk pulling the skull off a child or something?
No, not necessarily that. But I kind of wanted to see some people lying in the streets. Maybe they're not dead, but obviously they've been injured by a car or debris or something like that. But it's one of those things where the one thing that I did find kind of bothered me about the film, it really smacks you over the head with get the bystanders out of the way.
Yeah,
I understand. I get that it's important. They're the heroes. They're supposed to save everybody. It's not really going to be very well received if they go into a fight and they've got just no regard for the people around them. I get it. But I really kind of felt like every time they turned a corner in the climax of the movie, somebody was saying, get them to safety. And I kind of felt like screaming back, I get it. You can stop showing people getting on boats. I understand. You've saved everybody, and I feel like you're gonna lose because you saved everybody. But same thing with that fight with the Hulk. That the getting everybody to safety would have had more weight if they had shown people dying, you know, at the hands of a mind controlled Hulk. And I'm not familiar enough with the comics to really even understand the Scarlet Witch. I'm not sure how her powers actually work. So you kind of had to read into whatever Whedon was telling you if you don't know that. Are you guys familiar with the books? Did you read?
I'm not. No, that's those two characters I'm not all that familiar with. It's mainly really the Speedster, just because of the X-Men films where they've had a different take on him.
Right.
Now, which really portrayal did you like guys like better?
Was Quicksilver in the X-Men movies?
Yeah, he was in Days of Future Past.
Yes.
Oh.
That genius scene with the guards.
Genius scene with the guards. I'm not remembering
that. He's just listening to music in his headphones and just picking out bullets and things.
Yep. Had the guy punch himself in the nuts.
Wow, I don't remember that at all.
Oh, my gosh.
I've seen that movie and I liked it, but I'm not remembering it.
One thing I will say, I give a lot of credit for the fact that when he dies in this movie, it didn't feel in any way like it was a sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice, in the way that a lot of TV shows do. Mm. Like at the very end, like in the final episode, they'll have somebody die as a huge sacrifice to make it all seem worthwhile. And it almost just seems forced these days because it's done so many times.
Mm.
But it was genuinely quite surprising. I was not expecting in a Marvel film for them to introduce a superhero and kill him off in the same movie.
Right. My fear, and I think you might be going to this way as well, Hammond, my fear was that Hawkeye was going to die.
Joss is the master of getting you to love somebody and then offing them.
Yeah. Well, and with all that buildup at the farmhouse with the kids, I was like, oh God, Whedon, yep. if you kill Hawkeye, it's no, I only heard little murmurs of people being on the fence. Most of the people that I saw on Twitter, because I was pretty careful not to read a lot of stuff, were praising the movie. So I only heard little rumors about Joss Whedon quitting Twitter and stuff like that. And I thought, oh God, what thing has he done that's going to be bold and have weight to it in this movie that has made some people just lose their every loving shit. And I was like, and halfway through this film, I was like, oh God, if he kills Hawkeye, I'm going to be so mad.
Yeah, I actually, my money was on the Falcon.
Really?
Yeah, because he's one of those characters we like. We like him.
Yeah.
He didn't really have much of a part in it, but I do like that he's in the final standing at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
The new team up, the new lineup.
Any criticisms, Alistair?
For me, it was pretty much the same as yourself with the whole "let's make sure that nobody dies."
Yeah,
you know, it was very much kind of, it's the impossible task that they want to achieve, but it seemed like they achieved it oh so very well.
Mm, yeah, Hammond.
I guess my biggest one is I felt like they were cramming so much in to progress us to the next film that some of it might have gotten lost. Like I feel the definite need to see it again, not because I enjoyed it, but I did, but because I feel like there are things that are important that I missed.
Yeah, and I started to feel overcrowded at the end. I was just like, you don't need War Machine. I didn't need him in any part of this movie. It didn't make any, you remove him completely and replace whatever he did in the final fight with Iron Man, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it added nothing.
The dinner party should have been where you had your little nods and cameos.
Yeah, like,
and
show up.
And the rest of it should have been the rest of the team just doing what the team does.
Yeah, I'm happy with, like, a team of, how many Avengers are there? Five, six? Six.
Six.
Yeah, and I'm okay with the addition of the Vision, which I thought was very cool. I knew about it from the trailer, and I had done some research because I remember the character visually from the books and thinking, like, man, I'm feeling that I know this character. And it was cool when I did some research and realized that it actually, in the books, I think it is Jarvis, but in this version, it's like a combination of Jarvis and the intelligence from the stone.
Mind stone. Yeah.
What are they called?
The Infinity Stones.
Infinity Stones. Thank you. And I liked his both calmness and his what's the word I'm looking for?
Naivety.
Yeah,
like he was only born yesterday.
Yeah, there's some fun moments. I like the fact that he's very collected, but at the same time, he pulls the trigger when he wants to. Like, he can open up and cause some shit when he feels like throwing down. And I thought that was great. And there's a scene at the end. When I feel like it's the Hulk and the Vision and Thor all rushing from left to right on the screen, and there's a couple scenes in the big fight where they're protecting the core, and then of course at the very, very beginning, and like Whedon has put a comic book on screen. Like, it is, you look at it and you're like, that is the 2-page spread in motion, you know, where you've got like, there's 20 bad guys in the screen, you've got your six heroes in the middle, and everybody is shooting somebody different and helping somebody else out all at the same time. And
parts are flying everywhere.
Everywhere. And it was very, very well executed. There's a couple of points where I just looked like this. It looks, it's even composed like a comic book, right? Like, it just, it's so well done in that respect.
I actually felt that from the first Avengers film, and I had got to the point when I saw the first film that I did not want to know anything about it. I wanted to be completely blown away to the point that I did not know that Joss Whedon had directed it.
Oh, wow.
And I was that oblivious to it. And I remember watching it and being halfway through that final battle and just thinking, you know what, with any other movie, I'd be bored by now because of how long this action scene has gone on.
Mm.
And when I saw Joss Whedon's name in the credits, I just thought, that makes bloody sense. Because when you think of everything that he's done, especially with like Buffy, Angel, Firefly, like all of these fight choreography scenes that he does, he's had so much experience doing that he's one of the best people to pull this kind of thing off. And these two movies, both of the Avenger films, are just complete testament to him being able to pull off this comic book style spread, as you say, in a way that nobody else really could.
Yeah, and I really felt the team aspect in the fight scenes. Like, I mean, Captain America was constantly throwing his shield to other people. They'd be tossing it to him, or people would set up bad guys to be knocked down by a stronger ally. Like, really, really cool stuff where, like, hey, they all lined up, and Captain America puts his shield up, and Thor hits it with the hammer, and the sound wave obliterates everybody. Like, it's just really, really sharp stuff. Stuff that we kind of learned in the first movie when they were fighting, when they were going at each other and not really teaming up, you know, realizing, hey, wait a minute, they could actually use some of this cool stuff to their advantage, and they've obviously learned how. And I thought that was really cool. The criticism that I have, and it's probably just because I've seen these movies a couple times, and we are now experiencing this boom of superhero movies. It's kind of, I imagine it's very challenging to come up with a threat to the planet that is large enough that feels threatening but doesn't repeat other movies, right? Alien invasion. Well, they did that last time, so they can't do it again. Then you've got the giant meteor. Well, when that city was rising up, I was having flashbacks of Superman Returns and the giant island being lifted up by Superman.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the pacing and the cinematics and everything, it was very, very similar. And then the opposite was, get everybody to safety. And that was precisely the complaint that everybody had about Man of Steel, is that no one got to safety. They didn't show anybody dying, but with buildings going down left, right, and center, with Zod and Superman fighting at the end, like, obviously some people died, right? Mm. And I feel like, in a lot of ways, probably because of the media response and the nerd response to Man of Steel, and then the fact that they were smacking us over the head with get everybody to safety in Avengers, I really kind of felt it was like, just don't say this about our movie. It's the one thing that you can't say is that we were as bad as Man of Steel with Collateral. You know, it almost felt like they were doing it on purpose, you know, to kind of make sure that they got that covered. And that it felt a little bit forced to me. That would be my complaint. I think, what was your favorite part, Alistair?
My favorite part? I think for me, it's just the build-up between the two sides where you've got Captain America and Iron Man. Just the conflict between them. Mm. I always love the more cerebral stuff like that, and you know, why people who are best friends suddenly become enemies, which is why I love Smallville, because of the whole Clark and Lex story.
Yep.
And I really liked seeing that develop through this movie. I think that's probably the thing that I enjoyed most.
Yeah.
Because they're on the same side, but man, they are not getting on with each other.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said favorite part. I meant favorite aspect, I guess, would be a better way to say that. Hammond, what about you? What's your kind of favorite takeaway from Ultron?
There are two things that stand out for me. One is the running gag of Steve Rogers and his calling out the potty mouth thing.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I loved the fact that that lasted the entire movie, and I was hoping that it would, and I'm so glad that it paid off. And the other thing that they did that was a running gag was the hammer, which paid off on knowing they could trust the Vision.
Yeah.
And I love this. It was in the trailer, and I love it when Captain America grows for the hammer, and it moves a little bit. And Thor's face, when he sees that, is priceless.
Yeah. Same with his reaction when the Vision picks it up. He doesn't even really say anything. He just kind of goes, okay. I got nothing.
This is one of the things I love about the way that Whedon's done it, is that I think a lot of directors and writers would have actually had a character verbally point that out. With this film, there are so many non-verbal cues like that, where it's just a glance. Like when Quicksilver gets shot by the police officer and he just looks and then shrugs, like, what the hell are you doing? You know, it's all the nonverbal stuff, which has been some of the funniest parts of that movie.
Yeah, there was a lot of humor. Humor in it.
My favorite scene in the first one was when Thor and the Hulk killed the one monster, and it's all done and said, and then Hulk knocks him off the monster with one punch.
Yeah, which happened again in this movie with the Hulkbuster and the Hulk, except the Hulk got punched this time. Yeah, no, I thought that was good too. I think my favorite thing about the whole movie was my surprise with Ultron. The performance and the instability of his, just like his mental instability was, I found it a lot more threatening. I could not really predict what he had. Like when that city started to lift off, it was only when the city started to lift off that my brain went back to his talk about the dinosaurs and I realized what he was doing. Like I did not know exactly what his plan was. The only thing I could predict was, of course, what I saw from the trailers, which was like a bunch of robots coming out of, you know, the ground and the water to attack the Avengers. And beyond that, I had zero idea what to expect. And I thought that his unpredictability was really, really well done.
The one moment, which was right at the beginning of his introduction, that made me think, oh God, what the hell is he going to end up doing in this film? Was when he realizes that he has no form, and he just says, this feels wrong.
Yeah.
There was something quite haunting about that, and it's like, this is a being who is obviously going to do something and try and, obviously he wants physical form, and at what point will that stop?
You kind of wonder, like, did he have a body before? Like, you know, we get where he comes from as far as before he was Ultron, he was in the Scepter, but there's no, well, how did he get into the stone? Who built the intelligence in the first place? Was it maybe a person before? Like, you know, there's this kind of weird, there's still some mystery behind him in terms of like what his emotional motivation would be.
Have you guys seen the movie Robots, the Disney?
Yes.
The Blue Sky, you mean?
Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
He kind of reminded me of the bad, slick businessman robot.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
The Vision is one character I had no idea about. I hadn't seen it in any marketing or anything, and that really surprised me. But I do love he is still very similar in a lot of respects to Ultron. He's just the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
And he has, whereas he even says that Ultron just sees death, he sees positivity in a lot of things. And he even saw value in Ultron, but it's just the whole kind of like, but him, his continued existence goes against everything else, and he has to be stopped.
Yeah.
And I thought that that's an interesting thing, and that I don't think you would ever have any of our human-based heroes ever saying that.
Yeah, no,
I think that's still a slight line, morality-wise, that they wouldn't be able to cross.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's the comparison to the Vision and Ultron being different sides of the coin is absolutely, absolutely bang on. Well, with that, I think we should probably wrap up. Hopefully everybody can have a chance to go see Age of Ultron in theaters. Definitely worth seeing in the theater. Don't wait for Blu-ray or some other nonsense. Definitely see it in the theater. Alistair, thanks for coming on the show, man. Appreciate the return. Where can people find your stuff online?
Over at www.omizod.com. And on Twitter, I'm at imcfly.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been still listening to the Citadel Cafe, and we will catch you all next week.